The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start this morning off with a little inspiration. Why we should rest on the Sabbath. And there's a picture of an older lady that says, Mother Olive's mementos are reminders of a simpler, slower time. And there's a picture of an open Bible, an older lady. It looks like a storefront of some sort. From Mother Ollie, I learned that taking time for yourself is a divine right, too. My great-grandmother was a lifelong Baptist. Mother Ollie, as we called her, attended Mass at my family's Catholic church in Birmingham, too, but she never drifted from her quiet adherence to the King James way of her youth. After church every Sunday, she went straight back to her room. On other days, she was always busy, shelling peas or snapping beans, crocheting or quilting or sewing. Her foot pedal singer was in daily use until a few weeks before her death in 1982, but she never sewed on Sunday. When I went looking for her help with a tatting project one Sunday afternoon, I found out why. Tatting is a kind of lace made with tiny knots tied in very fine string. The trick is to tie the right kind of knot without tangling the string into the wrong kind. But I had made so many of the wrong knots that I couldn't even figure out how to unpick the tangle and start again. I found her sitting in a chair, her Bible in her lap. The book was very old, with edges so worn that they curved inward toward the pages, and as soft as a puppy. I knocked on the open door. Mother Ollie, can you help me with this? Not today, honey, she said. The Lord tells us not to work on the Sabbath, and handwork, by definition, is work. I don't know anyone who takes Sunday off anymore. If we aren't doing professional work, we're doing the housework that won't get done once Monday comes. But it's not as though the world stopped on Sunday back in Alabama, either. The crops and the weeds in my grandfather's fields continued to grow whatever the day. My grandmother, a teacher, still had papers to grade and lessons to plan. The peas in the basket on the back porch would not shell themselves. Nevertheless, my people put work aside on Sunday to nap on a daybed or sit on the porch and rock. They didn't ask themselves, as I do, whether they could afford to rest. God obliged them to rest, and so they did. Today, there are many people for whom this kind of Sabbath is not an option. People who work double shifts or double jobs truly can't afford to rest. On the other hand, I could reorganize my life if I tried. I could focus on priorities, spend less time on things that matter a little to me, and make more time for those that matter most. Yet somehow I have reached the age of 57 without feeling any obligation to sit still. That changed one day after I returned home from a recent book tour. I love meeting book people with all my heart. By the end of the tour, all my body was in revolt. I sat on the sofa with my laptop, planning to get started on the 90 million emails that had piled up in my absence, but instead I fell asleep. I tried the wing chair next to the sofa with no better results. Then I found myself looking up the one clear spot on my desk as a good place to lay my head. I gave up and went back to bed, rousing myself barely in time for supper. Then I slept 11 hours more. Nothing in the fourth commandment identifies which day of the week should be the Sabbath. It doesn't even mention the need to attend church. Its chief requirement is to rest. Remember, the Sabbath day, to keep it holy, reads Mother Olive's Bible. 6 days shalt thou labor, and do all thy work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work. Reading those verses again made me wonder, what if resting all by itself is the real act of holiness? What if honoring the gift of our only life in this gorgeous world means taking time every week to slow down, to sleep, to breathe? The world has never needed us more than it needs us now, but we can't be of much use to it if we remain in a perpetual state of exhaustion and despair. The next day, I didn't even try to work. I took a walk around Radnor Lake in Nashville, where I live, the best possible way to celebrate a day of rest. The temperatures had finally dropped, the rains finally came, and Middle Tennessee was serving up one fine October day after another. At Radnor, the beauty berries were gleaming in all their purple ripeness, and the asters and the snake roots were still in bloom. Behind its mother, a fawn was foraging, its springtime spots just beginning to fade. A great blue heron was standing on a down tree at the edge of the water, preening each damp, curling feather, and sorting it into place. A fallen log just off the trail boasted a glorious crop of children of the woods, and the seed pods of the redbud trees were ripe and ready to burst. At the lake's edge, the sound of a lone cricket rose up from the skein of vegetation next to one of the overlooks. Its song was as beautiful and as heart-lifting as any hymn. Turkey Day Blues. If you're ever feeling down on yourself, just remember how in 2018, when I hosted Thanksgiving for my family, I told them to park in the wrong spot and every single person's car got towed. Sounds like 2020, doesn't it? My signature party dish is the one I realized I totally forgot to put out after the guests were gone. And a very good segue into the next section, which is sharpen your mind. Your brain was made for walking, just like the end of the last article. Creative inspiration is only a short stroll away. If a president, a legendary philosopher, and one of the best-selling authors of all time, credited the same secret for their success, would you try to follow it too? What if the secret was something you already knew how to do? In fact, you probably do it every day. Here's what Friedrich Nietzsche wrote. It is only ideas gained from walking that have any worth. Thomas Jefferson. Walking is the best possible exercise. Habituate yourself to walk very far. And Charles Dickett made it his point in uncharacteristic brevity. If I could not walk far and fast, I think, I should just explode and perish. Are you still sitting there reading this? Get walking. It's not just these three great minds who made a case for the prime creative booster. Researchers have traced numerous connections between walking and generating ideas. A Stanford University study found that the participants were 81% more creative when walking as opposed to sitting. According to the study, walking outside, versus on a treadmill, produces the most novel and highest quality analogies in participants who walked and then sat down to do creative work. Another famous person example. As part of his daily writing routine, Kurt Vonnegut would take a mid-morning break from his office to walk and then swim before eventually returning to work. I would argue that this habit was just a habit, but an intentional, necessary element of his creative process. The movement aspect of walking is obviously key. You probably heard the phrase, exercise your creativity, which refers to the brain as muscle. Our creative mindset is triggered by physical movement, which is exactly why walking, with your dog, a friend, or alone, feeds creative thinking. But the scenery is almost as important as the sweat. The National Human Activity Pattern Survey reveals that Americans spend 87% of their time indoors. Being inside, you're more prone to stagnation. The antithesis of energy. Without energy, you can't wonder or create. Disrupting your routine with a walk can be a catalyst for garnering fresh insights into problems or projects. Just by going outside, you are stepping out of your habitual surroundings and your comfort zone, which is necessary if you want to open your mind to new possibilities. You can walk through a tree-filled neighborhood. You can walk through a park and observe people sauntering or birds singing. Even when you walk down a busy street, you can't help but get distracted by the sweet cinnamon smells wafting from a food cart or the child pointing to a building you hadn't even noticed before. Our brains work harder to process in different environments. So walking outside fosters our ability to glean new ideas, to take in new sights, sounds, smells, and flavors. Shinrin-yoku, or forest bathing, is a common form of relaxation and medicine in Japan. It was developed in 1982, and recent studies demonstrate that being in the forest and walking among the trees lowers your stress levels. The effects are so powerful that Shinrin-yoku is now a government-endorsed policy in Japan. But you don't have to live near a forest to receive the psychological benefits. Research has shown that immersion in nature and the corresponding disconnection from the multimedia and technology increases performance on a creative problem-solving task by a full 50% in a group of hikers. So instead of setting a fitness goal, why not set a creativity goal that starts with walking? Engage more closely with your surroundings for the next 4 weeks. Turn off your phone and give yourself the chance to be present in the world, to hear conversations and natural sounds, to notice the way people move, the way the sun reflects in a puddle. Walk not just for exercise, walk for wonder. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with running back into the house for something you forgot. Was the stove still on? Why don't we have a little word power here? When a book is a bouquet, a collection of poems, essays, or stories is an anthology, from the Greek or anthos, flower, and logical collection, perhaps referring to the gathering of flowery verses into one volume. If you want to feel fancy, and even more floral, you can also call such a book a florilegium, from the Latin florigus, meaning calling flowers. And the answers are abridged. I'm sorry, the question is abridged. Is that adapted, shortened, or translated? It's shortened. Peter read an abridged version of War and Peace right before his book club meeting. Good idea. Riffle. Is that skim, brainstorm, or coffee from? Riffle is skim. Work has been so busy, I've had time to riffle through my inbox. Saga. Beach read, memoir, an heroic tale. A saga is an heroic tale. The latest Avengers saga was a box office smash. Prosaic. Is that uplifting, dull, or overly wordy? It's dull. In her weekly newspaper column, Mina can make even the most prosaic subjects feel profound. Omnibus. Is that a road atlas, a collection, or a paperback? It's a collection. Priya settled into an armchair with an omnibus of medieval poetry. Scrivener. Is that a critic, a writer, or a bookbinder? It's a writer. An amateur scrivener since middle school, Tim published his first bestseller in his 50s. Stanza. Is that a romance, a literary shelf, a library shelf, or a poem part? It's a poem part. What does the imagery of the second stanza tell us? The professor asked the class. Lexicon. Is that a dictionary, a villain, or a twisty plot? It's a dictionary. Armed with a bilingual lexicon and a pot of coffee, Jenny spent all night cramming for her French final. Hyperbole. Is that an overstatement? An understatement, a nonsense word. It's an overstatement. Since you're my only sibling, I could say without hyperbole that you're the best brother I've ever had. 10. Elegy. Is that a scientific paper, a mournful poem, or a beautiful quotation? It's an overstatement. Elegy. Is that a scientific paper, a mournful poem, or a beautiful quotation? An elegy is a mournful poem. Billy composed an elegy for Lee, his dearly departed goldfish. A tome. Is that a horror story, a poetry slam, or a large book? It's a large book. I can't believe you're using my antique Tolkien tome as a doorstop. Vignette. Is that a comedic play, a short scene, or reading glasses? It's a short scene. The novel's central mystery is revealed through a series of seemingly unrelated vignettes. Analogy. Is that a travel blog, a symbolism, or a comparison? It's a comparison. As long as a longtime football coach, my dad often used the sport as an analogy for life. Epigraph. An opening quotation, an illustrated guide, words said for the dead. It's an opening quotation. The book's epigraph comes from a Stevie Wonder song. Synopsis. Is that a Greek drama, a brief summary, or a cast of characters? It's a brief summary. Here's a synopsis of Moby Dick. It's about a whale and also a harpoon. Okay, normally we go full 30 minutes on a Reader's Digest, but we finished that Reader's Digest, and because the December-January Reader's Digest does not have quite as much material, I'm going to go ahead and do some consumer reports early here, which should give us enough time to get through December and January on the Reader's Digest. So let's start off with your COVID-19 travel toolkit. Since we are in the travel time right now, and things aren't exactly the greatest for travel, airlines and otherwise. And there's a picture here, a drawing of a bunch of people on an airplane, and they're all sitting on either the window or the aisle, except for one couple that appears to be sitting together, and there's three across with a child. And they give some number of questions. Air purified air from the vent towards your face. Find out if your airline leaves middle seats empty. A face shield over your mask may add protection. Sanitize shades, tray tables, and other surfaces you might touch. And that's what you should do. And try to be among the last passengers to board rather than the first. How to protect yourself and others when you're taking a plane, train, bus, or automobile. Travel can broaden our horizons, enrich our lives, and especially during the holidays, reunite us with loved ones. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, travel also increases our likelihood of getting and spreading COVID-19. That's news. While some Americans feel ready to take to the skies, rails, and roadways, this season, the risk may be too high. For others, including older people, smokers, and those with certain pre-existing conditions, says Ravina Culler, PharmD, an infectious disease specialist and spokesman for the Infectious Disease Society of America, those not at high risk should consider the possible threat they pose to the people they're visiting, Culler says. In general, all travelers need to practice basic safety strategies such as wearing a mask, maintaining physical distance, sanitizing frequently, touch surfaces, and cleaning their hands often and well. That means washing them with soap and water for a minimum of 20 seconds or using a hand sanitizer with at least 60% alcohol. Here, experts help you assess and reduce the risk of common modes of travel. Air travel. Airplanes may seem like the perfect environment for spreading germs, but because most jets are equipped with power HEPA air filtration systems and cabin air is replaced with fresh air every few minutes, experts say they're probably safer than many other enclosed environments. Even so, before booking a ticket, ask what the airline is doing to reduce passenger risk and encourage safety measures, such as mask wearing and physical distracting. Well, just about every airline is doing that now, so that's not an issue. Delta, for example, says it will block middle seats through at least January 6th, and probably later now. Southwest will do the same through at least October 31st, and obviously they're all going longer than that. Does the airline require a mask? If so, will crew members prevent someone from boarding who refuses to wear one? Also ask if the aircraft you'll be on has HEPA filters, if surfaces are wiped down between flights, and if the plane is thoroughly cleaned overnight. For the flight, take along cleaning supplies like disinfecting wipes or cleaning solution with at least 60% alcohol, hand sanitizers up to 12 ounces as allowed, and several masks. A face shield worn in addition to a mask will help protect your eyes from potential infection and deter you from face touching, says Maria Alcade, M.D., Director of Infectious Diseases Research at the University of Miami. At the airport, put on a mask and practice physical distancing, said Aaron Glaff, M.D., Chair of Medicine at Mount Sinai South Nassau Hospital in Oceanside, New York. Just before boarding, use the airport restroom, which may be safer than the airplanes, and consider waiting to be among the last to board to reduce the number of travelers passing you on the way to their seats. To limit passengers' contact, carriers like United, Delta, and JetBlue are boarding by row, starting at the back of the plane. Some experts think that a window seat may reduce risk because of its distance from passengers and crew members walking in the aisle. Before settling in, disinfect anything you might touch, armrest, tray table, window shade, and air nozzles. When sanitizing your hands, while it's safest to keep your mask on for the entire flight, Alcade and Glatt say that removing it briefly for a snack poses low risk. Try to avoid common areas, like those near the bathroom and galleys, Allard said. Aiming the purified air from the air vent to your face might keep the viruses at bay, too. If you have to use the bathroom, remain masked, disinfect surfaces and knobs before touching them, and sanitize your hands after exiting. Trains. Traveling by trains presents risk, including being in close proximity to many others, but Amtrak has taken measures to reduce the likelihood of coronavirus transmission. Crew and passengers must wear masks. Trains are carrying fewer people, and cafe cars offer carry-out only. I would say Amtrak setup is about the best you can do, Glatt notes. Passengers can also put belongings on seat next to them to prevent anyone from sitting there. This way, we're encouraging more physical distancing, says Jason Abrams, an Amtrak spokesperson, adding that the climate control system replaces the air in train cars every 5 minutes. At stations and on the train, use touchless options for payments and opening doors. The CDC advises avoiding high-touch surfaces, such as those in restrooms, along with ticket machines, touch screens and turnstiles and handrails, and cleaning your hands promptly if you can't. Try to leave a row of seats between yourself and others. Glatt suggests disinfecting the arms of your seat, the tray table, and anything else you might touch. Clean your hands after disembarking. For longer trips, consider a roomette, which is a private compartment with a door, individual climate control, and seats that convert into beds. Having your own room on a train is ideal, Glatt says. Buses. Like planes and trains, buses bring people close together for extended periods. The level of risk will depend largely on the length of time spent on the bus, how crowded it is, and how the air is filtered, and whether or not everyone is wearing a mask. Ask what safety protocols the bus company you're considering has in place. Greyhound, for instance, requires passengers to wear masks and says it will not travel to anyone who doesn't comply. The company also says the AVAX HVAC systems on the buses continues to refresh the air, and the buses are sanitized before and after each trip with CDC-recommended disinfectants. But Greyhound doesn't limit the number of passengers, so you could find yourself elbow to elbow with a stranger. Experts recommend the same safety protocols you'd use on a train. Be extra careful in the bathroom, Glatt says. Keep your mask on, wipe down surfaces before touching them, and wash your hands. Use a hand sanitizer. Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for that loud noise. Some idiot forgot to turn off his phone. Oh, my goodness, who could that be? It must have been me. Sorry about that. Anyway, that problem has been resolved, and that will not happen again, hopefully. Anyway, they're talking about the same protocol on your on the train as you would on your an airplane. Okay, let's look at rental cars, taxis, and more. If you're renting a car and traveling alone or just with your family, I don't think there's really much to be concerned about, Glatt says, noting that many rental companies are now deep cleaning vehicles between customers. If you want to be extra cautious, swab the steering wheel, shifter and knobs, door frame and handles, seat belt buckles, and other high-touch surfaces with a disinfectant wipe or a cleaning solution with which at least 60% alcohol. Experts also recommend washing your hands before driving and opening the windows to air out the vehicle. To avoid lines and contact with rental agents, consider programs such as Hertz Gold and Avis Preferred, which allows you to go straight to a waiting vehicle. When refilling the gas tank, wear latex or nitrile gloves, I do, it's good you should too, or use a paper towel to grip the pump handle and press the keys. Clean your hands afterward. At rest stops, wear a mask, clean your hands after touching any surface, and eating your car outside away from other travelers. The best way to minimize risk in taxis and other for-hire vehicles is to make sure you, other passengers, and the driver wear masks, and the climate control system is set to draw in fresh air, and the windows are open at least partly. The latter may help to rapidly dissipate any tiny particles which could carry viruses created when you cough or speak. We found that opening the rear windows very quickly reduced the level of aerosol in the car running at typical city speeds, Six Jacks Caravanos, Dr. P.H., Professor of Environmental Public Health Sciences at New York University School of Global Public Health, who recently researched aerosol levels in several car models. Uber and Lyft currently require drivers and passengers to wear masks and encourage drivers to keep cars clean. Still, it's wise to sanitize your hands after touching objects like seatbelt buckles, door handles, and window buttons. And after you get out, you should also handle your own bags and sit in the back seat, says Caravanos, whose research found that plastic barriers between the front and the back seat may further cut risk. If you're really concerned, he says, the right rear seat, furthest from the driver, might be the best place to sit. Cruises. Currently, the CDC recommends that U.S. travelers defer cruise travel because of the risk of COVID-19 transmission on ships. The State Department also advises that Americans avoid cruises in cases outbreaks leave them quarantined in other countries. While some overseas cruises have resumed, traveling from the U.S. ports has been voluntarily suspended through at least October 31st, according to the cruise lines. Now, I don't know whether it's back up now or not. The Cruise Lines International Association, an industry group. Some lines have halted sailings even longer. I don't think it's going to be safe to get on a cruise any time this year, says Kular, the infectious disease specialist. Avoid penalties when plans change. In recent months, travel companies have adopted a range of policies regarding refunds, cancellations, and changes, and some are more accommodating than others, says William J. McGee, CR's aviation advisor, to protect yourself in case your plans change. Know the rules. Hotels and car rental agents are usually fairly flexible if you cancel a reservation before their deadline, but the policies of companies such as Airbnb and Vrbo often vary from property to property, says John Reihalt, Vice President, Public Policy, Telecommunications, and Fraud at the National Consumers League. Change your flight rather than canceling. In general, airlines refund the cost of a ticket only if they cancel a flight, but America, Delta, and United, and other airlines are now waiving change fees on domestic flights. So instead of canceling, just change your tickets. Avoid paying when you book. Car rental companies and hotels may offer lower rates if you pay in advance, but right now any modest break might not be worth the added risk. And don't rely on travel insurance. It might not cover a COVID-19-related cancellation, McGee says. Hotel, motel, Airbnb, six tips for safer stays. If your travel plans require you to stay overnight or longer at a hotel or motel or in a short-term rental, the following steps may reduce your chances of being exposed to COVID-19 and help you feel more at ease. Know what to expect. Home rentals like those through Airbnb and Vrbo require no interaction in lobbies or other public spaces. It's the same as your own home, where you control all the exposures once you settle in, says Jack Caravanos, Doctor of Public Health, a professor of environmental and public health sciences at New York University. That said, many hotels and motels now require staff and guests to wear masks in indoor public areas, offer contactless check-in and check-out, and encourage social distancing. Read reviews of any place you're considering to see whether the past guests say about cleanliness. You can also reach out to the host of short-term rentals to find out how they're limiting risks, says Chiquita Dev, Ph.D., an expert on hospitality branding at Cornell University School of Hotel Administration. An evasive reply should give you pause. Get info on cleaning policies. Airbnb has a voluntary program whose participants use approved cleaning products and set up 24-hour vacancy periods between bookings. Hotels may regularly sanitize high-touch spots and rooms, and some have suspended their daily housekeeping to further cut in-room transmission risks. Bring your bedding. Ravine Cooler, Ph.D., an epidemiologist, I'm having tongue troubles, recommends using your own bedding at hotels and motels to ensure it's clean. If I travel on business, I'll be taking along my own sheets and pillowcases, just in case, he says, if you want to be overcautious rather than not cautious enough. Sanitize on arrival. Before unpacking, disinfect high-touch surfaces like those in bathrooms, as well as counters, doorknobs, faucets, and light fixtures and switches. Don't forget small objects like keys or pens you may find in your hotel room. Open the windows to allow fresh air to circulate. At hotels where windows may be sealed shut, you should at least confirm with the management that the climate control systems has been inspected recently and are regularly maintained, Cooler says. Clean vending machine buttons and any other high-touch surfaces in public areas before using them. Maintain physical distance. Minimize your time in areas that could lead to contact with strangers closer than 8 feet, including lobbies, dining and reception areas, game rooms, and fitness centers. Consider eating meals in your room or outdoors. Avoid elevators. Try taking the stairs instead. Ask for a room on the lower floor if that's helpful. If you have to use an elevator, do so alone or with others from your own household. And you might also, when you're climbing the stairs, don't forget that the handrail may be dirty too, so you probably need to wipe that as you go along or clean your hands. And a little bit of a road report. News and expert advice to help you keep ahead of the curve. A heads up on headlights, and most of us have these on modern cars now. Turning on your headlights in bad weather makes your car more visible to other motorists and is required by law in some states, including North Carolina. But if you leave your headlights set in automatic mode, you should know that they don't always go on when you think they should. Headlights won't necessarily go on in rain or snow because they rely on light sensors to turn on and off automatically. And just because your dash lights and daytime running lights are illuminated doesn't mean your tail lights are on. A dash symbol like the one above, which shows a headlight with a bunch of bars in front of it, will let you know when your low beam headlights and tail lights are on. If you aren't sure, override the auto mode and turn them on manually. Ask our experts, should I use cruise control in the rain? Cruise control makes driving easier by holding the car at a steady speed. But when roads get slick, you're safer controlling your speed yourself. In wet conditions, when gentle brake and throttle control are needed, a human touch may be better at that. Even modern adaptive cruising control systems, particularly where responding to hydroplaning. The safest way to deal with a loss of traction is to gently let up on the throttle and coast until you regain control. Tech that prevents drunk driving could save thousands of lives. A new study from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety estimates that equipping all cars with alcohol detection technology could save more than 9,000 lives annually. One technology being tested automatically detects a driver's blood alcohol level by measuring their air around them. There's no need to blow into anything, and prevents the car from moving if the driver is over the limit. Drunk driving prevention technology can save lives and should be required in some form for all new cars, says William Wallace, CR's manager of safety policy. And there's a couple of vital statistics. Median price increase to equip one of the 11 top-selling U.S. models with optional blind spot warning. CR is advocating for this and other life-saving systems to come as standard equipment in all vehicles, and the cost is $2,510. And there's a recall on Ford Edge and Lincoln MKX. New ways car makers are getting you more miles per gallon. CR experts highlight gas-saving technologies you might find in your next car and explain how each can reduce fuel consumption, as well as the potential trade-offs of the driving experience. Although most automakers say all electric vehicles are the future, their engineers also are busy making fuel-efficient improvements to the gasoline-powered cars, SUVs, and trucks that most U.S. drivers still rely on. By the way, I'm going to apologize again for that horrible noise that took place a little while ago. That was a stupid part on my part. I thought I'd turned my phone off, but I hadn't. And the consumers shopping for new cars now face a hodgepodge of these innovations, such as gasoline direct fuel injection, automatic transmissions with more gear ratios, turbocharged engines, and stop-start systems that shut off engines instead of allowing it to idle. Few of these technologies significantly increase fuel efficiency or reduce tailpipe emissions on their own, but working together, they can have a cumulative effect. To help car shoppers navigate these fuel-saving features, CR's talked with manufacturers, experts, and consumers to find out exactly how each technology works, and combine those insights with observations from our own testers, who've evaluated these features in real-world driving conditions. We found that some of these technologies, such as turbocharged engines, can end up by compromising drivability and sometimes cause reliability problems. There are no free rides in this business, says Gabe Sheraton, Associate Director of CR's Auto Test Program. Drivers might find the stop-start annoying. Actually, I had that on a car, and it was annoying. Or turbo lag could make a car hesitant to accelerate. Aerodynamic styling might result in lower, curvier car that compromises visibility and ease of access. In the charts and illustrations on these pages, which we'll talk about in a little while, you can discover which vehicles deliver the most miles per gallon and learn the benefits of each gas-saving technology, as well as any potential drawbacks. You can arm yourself with this information as you shop for a new or used vehicle. Most of the highest MPG vehicles we highlight are hybrids, meaning they combine internal combustion engines and electric motors to save fuel. Most also have electronic continuously variable transmissions, ECVTs, which can save energy by regulating engine speed. A few of the models in our list have traditional gas-powered engines and achieve strong fuel economy by using hybrid technology. We do not highlight any battery-only electric vehicles called EVs because they don't use any gasoline and currently represent only a sliver of the U.S. new car market. Diesel-powered cars also get good fuel economy, but they're not on our list because they're not necessarily clean or burning, and the selection among U.S. passenger vehicles has dwindled. The newest gas-saving innovations taken together made it possible for a pickup truck to achieve highway fuel economy in the mid-20s, to say nothing of the many SUVs and cars that now push into the 30-plus mile-per-gallon range. The gains have shown up across the board. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, average fuel efficiency for new cars in the U.S. improved a record 25.1 miles per gallon in 2018 and was projected to reach 25.5 miles per gallon in 2019. In the process, automakers have decreased harmful tailpipe emissions by about 1.7%, a new low that has environmental and public health benefits. When car manufacturers record an increase in miles per gallon, it's due to the collective use of multiple technologies, says Bassem Ramadan, Ph.D., head of mechanical engineering department at Kettering University in Flint, Michigan. There is no single technology that is or will be the silver bullet that will dramatically improve fuel efficiency and reduce emissions at the same time. What about EVs? So why all this innovation with gas-powered engines, even though electric vehicles clearly outperform all gas-powered cars when it comes to energy efficiency? The case for them is strong. EVs use no gasoline and emit zero tailpipe emissions. They can also be quick and very satisfying to drive. An exclusive CR analysis shows big savings on maintenance and operating costs over time, when compared with traditional gasoline-powered vehicles? The answer to that is EVs are not yet a solution for many drivers and are up against several obstacles that so far have held back wider adoption. Long charging times, limited but ever-increasing battery range, and bigger price tags. So far, there haven't been much market demand for EVs, which along with plug-in hybrids accounted for less than 2% of U.S. vehicle sales last year, despite the increasing popularity of the technology. Automakers have been slow to build EVs in part because until recently battery costs have been quite high, says Chris Harto, senior transportation policy analyst at CR. That is rapidly changing. Expect to see a lot more compelling EVs over the next few years. Based on a flurry of automaker announcements, it's clear that the industry has plans to move toward more electric models. For example, BMW and Mercedes-Benz, leaders in automotive research and development, say they plan to reach 50% electrification across their lineups by 2030. And certain other brands, such as Volvo, had pledged to eventually have an EV option for every model they offer. Some newer automakers, notably Tesla, offer only EVs. At the same time, Tesla and other companies have been building out national public charging networks with a growing number of DC fast charging stations that can make on-the-road charging more palatable for drivers. As of 2019, there were almost 27,000 public and private charging stations located across the U.S., with over 85,000 outlets, about double the number from 2015, according to the Federal Alternative Fuels Data Center. Depending on the battery and charging requirements, fast chargers can add 60 to 80 miles to EV range in 20 minutes, about the time it takes to eat a quick meal on the road. The reality is that most of the effort on internal combustion engines is starting to wind down in favor of electric development, says Sam Abulsamed, principal research analyst at Guidehouse Insights, a market research firm. Much of the restructuring we've seen at automakers and suppliers in the last few years has involved getting rid of engineers with engine expertise in favor of more software and electrical engineers. That's where all the major action is today. EVs offer big savings over gas-powered vehicles. Battery electric plug-in vehicles are more efficient and usually cost less to run than comparable gasoline and hybrid-powered vehicles. For many consumers, the downside of buying an EV is the upfront purchase price. But a new CR analysis shows that EV owners save thousands on repair and maintenance costs over time compared with consumers who own cars with gas-powered engines. EVs require less frequent maintenance because their electric motors and other drivetrain components have fewer moving parts. As a result, manufacturers tend to offer longer factory warranties on EVs. With an EV, you still change the brakes, tires, and wipers, but there is no engine oil, timing belt, or head gasket, says Gabe Sheraton, Associate Director of CR's Auto Test Program. EV maintenance costs are likely to decrease further in the coming years. The Department of Energy is working with the auto industry to bring down the cost of batteries to less than $80 per kilowatt hour from their current price of $156 per kilowatt hour. The chart below compares the average cost of repairs and maintenance for EVs, plug-in hybrids, and traditional gas-powered cars at various stages of their life up to 200,000 miles. Gas only is the first 50,000 miles, it's $1,411. For a plug-in hybrid, it's $1,084. For an all-electric plug-in, it's $577. At the first 100,000 miles, it's $4,400 for the gas only, $2,600 for the plug-in, and $1,900 for the all-electric. At the lifetime, over 200,000 miles, it's $12,285 for the gas, $5,915 for the plug-in hybrid, and the electric is actually a little more expensive. It's $82.76. So that's an interesting reversal there. Fuel economy revolution. Most vehicles sold in the U.S. are still powered by gasoline internal combustion engines, with turbocharged models on the rise. But that is changing to more gas-electric hybrid, plug-in hybrids, and battery electrics hit the market. There are various technologies under the hoods of today's most efficient cars. Small displacement turbo engines. Turbocharging boosts power by pushing more air in, allowing the engine to burn more fuel. This generates more power from a given engine size, giving on-demand acceleration and improved fuel economy under a light load. Potential drawback, uneven acceleration or turbo lag when starting out. Mild hybrid. provides some electric assist to traditional gas-powered engine, but does not provide electric-only driving. The system smooths out the stop-start feature by keeping accessories running when the engine shuts down to save fuel. Potential drawback: the name might suggest more fuel economy gains than these cars can actually deliver. And then there's the hybrid. It combines a combustion engine with an electric motor, or motors, to improve fuel economy. The engine, along with braking and cushioning, automatically recharges the battery. These systems typically provide minimal electric-only driving. The potential drawbacks are added weight and mechanical complexity. Plug-in hybrid. Like a hybrid, but it has a larger battery and increased range with electric-only driving, significantly reducing fuel consumption for daily trips if charged often. The battery is recharged by plugging the car into an outlet. Potential drawbacks: added weight and large battery can steal cargo space. Need to frequently charge to get full benefit. And the pure electric EV, a high-voltage electric motor or multiple motors, replaces the combustion engine for propulsion, and a rechargeable battery replaces the gas tank. EVs don't use any gasoline, and they operate quietly and cost less to run. The potential drawbacks are shorter range compared with a gas-powered car and long charging times. Fuel-saving technology. See our experts highlight key gas-saving innovations you might find on your next car. They explain how each works along with the potential drawbacks for driving experience. Active grille shutters. The shutters depicted in the close-up image, and there's a picture of them here, are closed during driving to save fuel by improving aerodynamics. Not sure what that does to overheating, though. Continuously variable transmission. The steel teeth in the image below are part of a special belt that expands and contracts in a CVT to replace traditional gear shifting. That's interesting. 8, 9, 6, and 10-speed automatic transmissions. A wider wear of gear reduces engine speed during highway driving to improve efficiency and save fuel. This also can provide quicker acceleration. The potential drawbacks are, in some cases, downshifting can feel slow, and frequent shifting at lower speeds can feel clunky. Active grille shutters, and I've mentioned those before. Aerodynamics, sleeker body degree that reduces drag can improve fuel economy. Sedans are usually more aerodynamic than large boxy SUVs and trucks. Improvements in the area can result in less wind noise and sleeker, sportier designs. The potential drawbacks are rakish styling can squeeze interior space and impede your visibility. And your continuously varied transmission, which I mentioned before, it replaces traditional transmission gears with a setup that makes continuous adjustments to the gear ratio, smoothing operation and keeping the engine at optimal operating speed. And a potential drawback is more pronounced engine noise. Cylinder deactivation. And this started a number of years ago. I remember seeing it in a couple of cars, and it was a problem, but I think it's improved. Cuts off the fuel supply to specific cylinders when full engine power is not required, improving fuel economy for larger engines. The potential drawbacks: some early systems can have mild vibrations when cylinders activate or deactivate. That was an issue. Electric steering. A small electric motor provides power assist to the steering mechanism in place of an engine-driven hydraulic pump. Reduced load on the engine brings down fuel consumption by about 5%. Potential drawback: reduced steering feedback can diminish road feel. Low rolling resistance tires. Special rubber compounds and tread designs can reduce the friction generated from a rolling tire, reducing the injury needed to drive the car forward. The potential drawback: the compounds in these tires can increase wet stopping distances. Regenerative braking. Found in hybrids and electric vehicles, the system converts energy from braking and coasting into electricity, which can help recharge the battery. This provides increased electric range and fuel economy on hybrids. Potential drawbacks: the system can affect coasting ability and brake pedal feel. Stop-start. This feature saves fuel by automatically shutting off the engine when the vehicle comes to a stop to avoid excessive idling at red lights or in standstill traffic. The engine starts automatically. Potential drawbacks: can cause hesitation and shutter on restart and compromise the performance of the AC and other accessories during the shutdown. And then here's a list of the most efficient, the ratings for the fuel-efficient vehicles. And on cars, the Honda Insight Hybrid is number one. The Honda IONIQ Hybrid is number two. The Toyota Prius Hybrid is number three. And the Toyota Corolla Hybrid, Honda Accord Hybrid, Toyota Camry Hybrid, Kia Niro Hybrid, Toyota Avalon Hybrid, Toyota Corolla Hatchback, Kia Forte, and Volkswagen Jetta all get fairly good ratings. SUVs: The Lexus UX250H is the highest rated. Toyota RAV4 Hybrid, Honda CR-V, Toyota Highland Hybrid, Ford Escape Hybrid, and Honda HR-V all have similar rankings. Full-size pickups, the Ford F-150, it's okay, but not great. The Chevrolet Silverado 1500 also got relatively good. Ram 1500 and Nissan Titan are not bad, and the Toyota Tundra got the best rating of all. And now we'll have a letter from the president of Consumer Reports. Bridging the Trust Divide. It's almost impossible to comprehend all that has happened in the past year and adjust to our new normal. There have been so many seismic disruptions, and the ground is still shifting under our feet as we continue to grapple with the worst public health crisis in a century. Our nation is facing incalculable grief and loss, economic distress, and an overdue reckoning with issues of race and justice, and these challenges are only made more difficult by the deep divisions in our country. We are experiencing the stresses of a democracy faces when its citizens can't trust the information they hear and read. This past year, we have seen the direct and dire harms related to COVID-19 misinformation, versions of the same stories that plague so many families forced to wonder whether they can trust the health of their tap water or the safety of the products they buy. The threat is severe, but what has been encouraging is to see the entire CR community unite in common purpose to seek out and instill greater truth in the marketplace. As an organization, CR has always been driven by the fact-based solutions and by the belief that a healthy, free, and prosperous society is built on trust. Our work is guided by scientific rigor, independent investigations, research and advocacy, and has been informed by what consumers are experiencing in the marketplace. I want to thank all of you for your support, which allows our nonprofit to bring you trusted information. As we enter this holiday season, we are proud to continue to stand with you, deliver for you, and advocate on your behalf, no matter what disruptions the world has in store, because safety, fairness, and trust have never been more important. Be well and stay safe. Building a better world together. Student loan protection. What's at stake? Student debt in the U.S. now is up to almost $1.7 trillion. That makes student loans the second largest class of household debt in the country, trailing only home mortgages and ahead of credit card and auto loan debt. On average, 45 million borrowers each owe more than $37,000 each. That kind of debt was hard enough to manage before the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, with millions of jobs destroyed and the U.S. economy struggling to right itself, it represents a full-blown crisis to many students and their families. Making matters worse, the system for repairing student loans has become complex, confusing, and ever abusive, and is woefully lacking in consumer protections. Student loan services compared, companies such as Fed Loan Servicing, Great Lakes, Navient, Nelnet, and Sallie Mae are the main points of contact for many people trying to pay off their loans and are supposed to be there to help. Instead, they sometimes add to the borrower's burden. State and federal investigations have shown that some of these for-profit companies routinely lose paperwork, misapply payments, and provide borrowers with increased inaccurate information, and even steer borrowers into more costly repayment options. How CR has your back. Consumer advocates at CR have been working at the state and national levels to make the system work better for everyone. In September, that effort took a major step forward with the signing of California's Student Borrower Bill of Rights, the strongest such protection in the nation. The law, co-sponsored by CR, takes aim at abuses that make student loan debt more costly and trigger defaults. Among other things, it requires loan services to act in the best interests of borrowers, a common-sense principle that, unfortunately, is often frequently ignored. The law also mandates that loan servicers apply payments in a way that minimizes extra fees, improves their record-keeping, and trains staff to provide accurate information about repayment options. And establish a student loan ombudsman, a designated advocate for borrowers who will investigate consumer complaints, issue reports to the state legislature, and refer violations to enforcement authorities. About a dozen other states have passed legislation to expand student loan oversight since 2015, when Connecticut became the first. What you can do. If you're struggling to make your student loan payments, tell us your story at crorg.org/edloan1220. Taking a stand. Broadcast teleservices wants federal communication commissions to rule that the current requirement that robocalls be made only with a consumer's prior consent doesn't apply to calls by state and local governments. Fearing a new avalanche of robocalls, CR is opposing the request. CR is also fighting a Department of Energy proposal that would poke holes in a rule limiting the water flow of showerheads to 2.5 gallons per minute by redefining each nozzle as a multi-nozzle fixture as a showerhead. The move could waste water and energy and swell consumer utility bills. A new watchdog. What's at stake? 10 years ago, CR successfully pushed for a federal watchdog that would make sure banks, lenders, and other financial companies treat consumers fairly and could put a stop to fraud and other abuses in the financial marketplace. But in recent years, the agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has scaled back enforcement of consumer protection laws and reduced penalties on firms caught abusing customers. This is happening even as the COVID-19 crisis leaves Americans especially vulnerable to financial scams and predatory lending. How CR has your back. As with student loans, CR has been pushing for state laws that would fill regulatory gaps at the federal level, and again, efforts in California are paying off. In September, as part of its budget process, the state created CFPB-like Department of Financial Protection and Innovation, with broad jurisdiction over the financial services industry, including authority to oversee debt collectors and credit reporting agencies. The agency will monitor the marketplace for patterns of abuse and seek relief for consumers ripped off by financial firms. This proposal should serve as a model for other states seeking to strengthen oversight of the financial industry and ensure that consumers are treated fairly when they pay their bills, can manage their debts, and have a real shot at building family wealth and security, says CR Senior Policy Counsel Suzanne Martindale. What is consumer research reports testing in our labs? In our 63 labs, we continue reviewing rate products. Here are the timely picks for this month. Computer monitors. We tested 6 models. We test for display quality, image clarity, color accuracy, and contrast for both text and photos, versatility, including adjustable height, and more. The median score is 67. The range is 47 to 69. And the best overall quality was a Dell U2419HC 24-inch at $310. The large versatile screen was a Dell U2719DC at 27-inch, and that was $460. That also got a high score, 67. And the bargain, but not adjustable, the Acer ED242QR 24-inch, $150, got a 55 overall score. We tested 42 models of food processors. We test for how well a model chops onions and almonds, slices celery and mushrooms, shreds carrots and cherries and more, cheese and more. About the scores, the median was 58, the ranges rated from 35 to 81. The 89 was the top-notch chop, Breville Sous Chef, BPFB800XL/A, 16 cups, $400. No wonder it's the top rated. The 78-point excellent value, the Oster Preza Pro Service Blender Food Processor, BLST-VB, at 4 cups, is $150. And the 30-year motor warranty, the Magnix 4200XL, 12 cups at $400, got a 71. Most of the year I cook for two. Should I use a full-size food processor? Full-size food processors aren't overkill for small portions. Their bowls aren't just overkill for small portions. Their bowls are too big to chop the food well, says CR tester Kara Gassaruguela. Some larger models, such as Breville and Magnamix above, include multiple sizes of bowls and blades. Or you can offer a smaller 4- or 5-cup model. But you may be able to get by without a food processor altogether. A small food chopper has blades to help speed up a meal prep without taking much counter space. Blender's blades, while typically not as sharp as a food processor's blades, can take on some larger tasks too, such as pureeing ingredients to make soup. Drills. We tested 12 general use models. They test for power from max RPM to stall, measured using a dynamometer, speed of drilling holes and driving screws, runtime, and more. About the scores, the median is 54, the range is 26 to 71. The 71 was an extra power and handling Makita, FD07R1 at $160. Another 71 was the great power for your buck, which is DeWalt DCD701F2 for $100. And a 60, which not a bad score, quick to recharge the Milwaukee 2407 at $130. Low flush toilets. We tested 43 models. We test for how well a model moves simulated waste, how well flushing clears the bowl and noise. We also note the gallons of water used per flush. Median was 71, the range was 34 to 84. At 78, the excellent all-around was American Standard Champion Formax at $2586 at $240. Great at bowl cleaning, the Waller Kelworth K375 at $250. That got a 74. And at a 71 was used less water but noisy is the Gerber Ultra Flush UL20, $520. Sound bars for $250 or less. We tested 20 models. We test for sound quality, how easy it is to use to set up, use a model system, ease of use, non-TV features, and more. Full-featured and best sound was the Polk Command Bar at $250. By the way, the median was 52, the high was 60, low was 30. And that got a 57, and that's $250. The basic bargain buy was Creative Stage 21, $90. Then also got a 57 for an overall score. And a 56 was the easy-to-use basic bar, the Bose Solo 5 TV sound system at $180. And car seats. We tested 55 models, protection and stimulated crash test, how easy it is to install in a variety of vehicles, and more. About the scores, the infant was 68, to range of 42 to 90. The toddler booster was the median was 70, range was 38 to 82. Excellent infant car seat. Chico Key Fit car seat at $160. Got an 89 over car. The best toddler booster overall, the Graco Nautilus Snugglock LX at $205. And that got an 82. A safe deal for toddlers was the Costco High Back Booster, $42. And that got a 75 overall score. How can I safely tie a tree to my car roof? If you're planning to pop a pine tree on top of your car's roof this year, transporting a tree incorrectly could pose a hazard to you, your car, and other drivers on the road, says Jen Stockberger, Director of Spontaneous Operations at CR's Auto Test Center. It can also put a dent in your wallet. Every state drivers can be fined if an item falls from their vehicle with fines as high as $5,000. According to a 2019 survey by AAA, 60% of Americans who plan to buy a real tree said they previously had one fall from their car in transit. Unless you're buying a tree small enough to fit inside your vehicle, you need a roof rack. Tying a tree onto your roof without one is a safety hazard. Plus, branches can scratch your car. Looping twine through the doors can tear the door seals. Put a tarp under the tree and don't use the rope from tree sellers. It isn't strong enough. Use dedicated tie-downs such as nylon ratchet strips and anchor the tree just above the low bottom branches. It's best to face a tree trunk forward for better aerodynamics. Also, be sure the driver's vision isn't obscured. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-513.